Blog Talk Radio.
Singing songs that have come to me, and we've been singing songs from Marie Summerwood. And Marie Summerwood is a wonderful goddess chant maker. And if you don't know her work, look for Marie Summerwood. She is the one who wrote Let It In, Let It Go, Round and Round We Flow. And the chant that we sung at the end last night, Dance in a Circle of Women, and a great many other really wonderful chants that you will very, very much enjoy. She also comes to communities and helps women learn how to make songs. Another one of my favorite goddess chant women is Lisa Thiel. And I don't know if you know Lisa Thiel's work, but the spirit of the plants has come to me in the form of a beautiful dancing green woman is Lisa Thiel's chant. And I first heard that chant, oh goodness, maybe 25 years ago, at a conference up in Canada. And Ralph Blum, he calls himself the Runatic, played a cut from her. It was a tape at that point. There weren't CDs yet. And it was a white buffalo woman. I seek your wisdom. And afterwards, I went up to him and I said, who was that singing that you played? And he said, do you want to hear more? And I said, yes. He says, then come to my room. So I went to Ralph's room, and he played the whole thing for me, and I left with the tape and did that kind of thing, you know, where you're driving home and you just push again, 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 and you're just listening again, again, again. And I was so taken with the spirit of the plants that I wrote to Lisa, and I said, this is a great song, and I want you to know it's mine. And she wrote back this kind of, who the are you? Claim this song. I can't believe your nerve. She didn't say that, but it was pretty obvious in the letter. Right. And about a year later, we were invited to co-lead a group in Jamaica. And at the end of our time together in Jamaica, Lisa turned to me and she said, you're right. Spirit of the Plants is your song. It has. So I'd like to start this morning with another Lisa Thiel chant. And this is a chant that we sing every morning at the Wise Woman Center. I invite you, when you're singing this with me, to remember what we were talking about last night. Remember I said that corn is not just Zia maize, it is all grain, and that the word corn derives from kore, which comes from Kunda, who is the great goddess of the Kunt. So when we are singing to the Corn Mother, we are not just merely singing to Zia Maize, we are singing to all of the grains. And the grains are really taking a beating these days. Too bad. I started teaching by teaching bread baking. We called the class The Best Bread You Ever Ate. You make it yourself with love. And it hurts my heart to see how wheat and gluten are being trashed. Really, really does. These are the mainstays of human civilized life on this planet. The step that took us out of being hunting-gatherers was planting wheat, planting the grains, and that is why everywhere in the world the Corn Mother, in whatever guise she is, has been so deeply honored. It's a chant, sing along. Good Corn Mother, come to me, make my way sacred, fill me with beauty. Secret Corn Mother, come to me, make my way sacred, fill me with beauty. Fill me with beauty. Fill me with beauty. Fill me with beauty, that I may bring others beauty. Secret Corn Mother, come to me. Make Keep my way secret, to me with beauty. Secret, good mother, come to me. Make my way secret, to me with beauty. Fill me with beauty, fill me with beauty. Fill me with beauty, that I may bring others beauty. I do not see a lot of lips moving. And I will tell you that two of my mentors have instructed me not to teach anyone who hasn't been singing. And you are actually getting off very lightly here. One of those mentors is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, no longer with us. And before she would teach us, we had to sing for an hour. And she wanted every mouth moving. And the other mentor is Jean Houston, still with us. Wonderful woman. If you can connect with her, do so. And we had to dance and sing for half an hour before she would teach us. I'm just asking you to sing one little song. Secret, good mother, come to me. Make my way sacred to me with beauty. Secret, good mother, come to me. Make my way sacred to me with beauty. Fill me with beauty, fill me with beauty, fill me with beauty, that I may bring others beauty. Some years ago, I was invited to go to Toronto and teach at a naturopathic college there. And I said, oh, wonderful. I would like to teach about the amazing Artemisias. And at first they said yes, and then they called me back and they said, no, you can't do that. And I said, oh, why not? And they said, well, there's psychoactive plants among the Artemisias. I said, yes. So, well, we don't want our students to know anything about psychoactive plants. Doesn't seem like a well-rounded education to me. You will find, if you haven't yet, that in your exploration of herbs, the fastest way to learn about plants is to first learn a little bit about botany. I know it can seem kind of off-putting, and there's those strange words, but they're not Latin.
Right.
I took 4 years of Latin. They're not Latin. If anybody says it's the Latin name of the plant, you say, no, it's not. There are no Latin names of the plant.
Right.
They are the botanical names of the plant. As a matter of fact, the roots are more from Greek than from Latin. So if you wanted to name a language, you could call it the Greek names of the plants. But the botanical names of the plants is really what we're talking about. Now, to me, botany is quite fascinating. But you need a book that really brings you into it. And right at the bottom of your sheet, you have my favorite book, and it's called Botany in a Day. I must, however, complain mildly. The first edition of this book was the simplest handbook to learning botany that I have ever seen in my life, and it was brilliant. And I highly recommended it. The second, third, and fourth editions got more and more complicated. I think he's up to the sixth edition now, and you can hardly understand it. Well, what, you know, our first books are usually better because we're simple. Right? We don't know enough to make it complicated. So if you can find an earlier edition, I recommend it. They are better than the more current editions, but they're all good, and you will be able to get through it. As a matter of fact, the back side of your page is a page from Botany in a Day. And, of course, you cannot learn everything about botany in a day, but you can learn about one plant family in a day. As a matter of fact, you can learn about one plant family in the time it's going to take us to be together here. Now, the families of plants and the whole botanical classification was laid in the lap of a bad boy named Carl Linnaeus. And Linnaeus was indeed a very bad boy. Wasn't just plants. He also did mushrooms. And he has mushrooms named Vanagitopsis, Clitoria, Saliodes. Right. A lynch mob gathered in front of Linnaeus's house. They wanted to kill him. Why did they want to kill him? Because he put the lie to a common myth about flowers. Why do we have flowers in churches? Why do we take flowers to people who are sick? What are we thinking about when we make flower essences? All of these things are based on this myth about flowers, which is that they are pure, holy, and non-sexual. And nothing could be further from the truth. Imagine if I said, I soaked my twat in water overnight. Here, drink this for world peace. That's what they're doing, gang. Don't let them convince you. I am not saying that mind medicine doesn't work. Mind medicine works. The best paying job I ever had, I was hired by a company who was a front for such a large corporation that they didn't want anyone who was doing this kind of work that I was doing for them to know who they were. And I was paid $500 an hour plus all expenses to consult for this company who wanted to bring out a line of bottled water with herbs in it. And I said, don't. You will get in so much trouble. You're going to have two legal departments to deal with it if you start putting herbs in water. And they said, well, you know, there's this stuff with ginseng in it. And I said, yeah. I said, but really, trust me, don't go there. Do you know about the work of Emoto? The man who does like the crystal water. And they said, no. I said, well, look up his work. And you got to understand that what he's doing is not really what he says he's doing. Right, let me give you an example of this. I'm in Germany. I'm in a big building, and I'm looking for an exit. Now, of course, it's not going to say exit, is it? So I'm kind of thinking, what is it going to say? Okay, I've been on the Autobahn, and it says Ausgang. And I know that gehen is the verb to go, so Ausgang, go out. All right, so I'm going to look for an Ausgang. And I find a door, and it says N-O-T, Ausgang. What does it mean? N-O-T is the German word for emergency. You see, words are meaningless, aren't they? You can put any word you want on anything, and it has no meaning whatsoever. What has meaning is your intention. Emoto's intention is there, and the water responds to his intention. That is mind medicine. It is our intention that causes the effect. There is no need to buy water with the sexual organs of plants soaked in that water. None at all. You want to use mind medicine, you take water, you put your intention in it, you give it to someone, or you drink it. That's all you need to do. You do not need to pay anybody anything at all. So people were furious at Linnaeus for not only saying that flowers were the sexual parts of plants, but classifying them based on the size of their penises and how many clitorises they had. Basically, that's what he did. Now, Charles Darwin's dad, Erasmus, put out a 2-volume set of rhymed iambic pentameter verses on the sexual parts of plants. It is a stitch. It makes healing-wise look really tame. And people begged me not to publish the part about the plants talking before that book came out. But Erasmus really goes to town on it. He says, she carries a beautiful parasol to tall suitors, two small suitors follow in her wake. Woo! So this is what we're looking at. Plants are not classified. Linnaeus did not choose to classify plants based on their colors, their leaves, their roots, where they grow, their uses. He based his classification of plants on their sexual organs. So in order to know about a family of plants, we need to know what the flowers look like. So let's look at the flower of a mint family plant. We can see why Linnaeus called this family the Labiatae. What's a labia? Lips, yes. Can you see the lips in this plant? Right, in German, the Lippenblumen. All right, the lipped flowers. Yes, how wonderful. Now, sometimes you get a plant with a big lower lip and a kind of small upper lip. And sometimes you get one with a big upper lip and a lower lip, right? And that's the here we have a picture of one with a big lower lip and not so much of a upper lip. They're not always equal, although they sometimes can be. When we first look at this, we might say there are two petals because we see these two lips. But this is a very old plant family. And over time, the petals of the flower have fused together. If we come down and we look at the part underneath the petals, which are called the sepals, and the sepals surround the petals of the flower. All flowers must have sepals, but they are not required to have petals. So the outermost part is the sepals. If that outermost part opens up and there's just the sexual organs of the plant and there aren't any petals, those still aren't petals. Those are sepals. And sepals are often green, but they don't have to be green. Think for a moment about a tulip. A tulip bud is colored, isn't it? And there are three sepals that form that tulip bud. And when those open, then inside are three petals of the same color. Right? We might think, oh, the tulip has six petals, but you must have sepals. This is the rule in botany. You have to have sepals. Okay, now often the sepals will give us a hint as to what's going on with the petals. And we see that there are indeed five sepals. And plants tend to follow patterns. If there's five sepals, you can be about 99% confident that there's going to be five petals. We also see that these sepals are united. We can see the little ends of them, but we see that they have come together, and so that also gives us the clue that the petals have united as well. And we then look at the upper so-called petal, and then with this knowledge, we can say, hey, that looks like two petals fused together, doesn't it? And this is quite obvious in this drawing, and it's actually usually obvious in most mint family flowers as well. And then if you look at the bottom one, well, oh, wow, there's like a little kind of ear, and then the lip, and another little kind of ear. Three petals fused together, right? The fused sepals are called a calyx. The fused petals are called a corolla. As we pull those apart, we are going to find inside the male and female genetic material, because in the mint family, the flower is perfect. Now we think that plants started out the way it was on college campuses when I went to college. There was the girls' dorm over here, and there was the boys' dorm over here. And so we think that plants started out like that. And there's still a great number of plants like that, aren't there? Most of the pine trees, the cedar trees, birch trees, aspens, a great many plants still have male on one side and female on totally different plants. Now, this is pretty hard on the boy plants because they have to get their pollen over there where the girl plants are. And so they tend to produce copious amounts of pollen, and they depend on the wind to blow it. And those pollens also, if you look at them under the microscope, look like medieval torture devices. They have spikes and hooks because they're blowing around, and they have to hook and grab on to the female parts. And I think this makes it pretty obvious why these pollens can cause allergic reactions. Right? You get a snot full of these little barbed balls, your nose is going to go, achoo, achoo, achoo. Right? You get them in your eyes are going to go, water, 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 excuse me, I'm not a female flower. Why are you hooking onto me? Go. And then things got a little closer so that there were male flowers and female flowers in the same dorm, but on separate floors. Like corn. What's the male flower of the corn? The part that's way up top, right? That part that's up on the top. And what's the female flower of the corn? Zia May's corn. The ear of corn is the result of the flower. And every kernel of corn is a single fertilized ovary. There are many, 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 many ovaries. And each ovary has a style that goes up to the stigma. And the stigma is the part that the male pollen sticks on, the sticky stigma. Now, the style is not a hollow tube. It is solid. When the pollen sticks on the stigma, if it is the pollen of that group of plants, then enzymes are produced that allows it to carve a channel through the style and get to the ovary. And if it's a pollen from some other type of plant, like if pine pollen lands on the corn, this doesn't happen. So the corn cannot be fertilized by any pollen except corn pollen. And there doesn't, in corn is very easy to crossbreed. If you've ever tried to grow corn in a home garden, you know that corn is wind pollinated. And one of the reasons we plant large acreage in corn is because you're never going to get corn on the outer edge. It's not going to get fertilized. If the pollen fails to get to the stigma and fails to get down the style and doesn't get to the ovary, then you're going to pull back the husk on that and those silks of the styles, and you're going to see little missing teeth, aren't you? Where it didn't get, that ovary didn't get fertilized. Huh? Squash is the same, isn't it? Ever seen anybody eat squash flowers? Did you ever wonder how they got any squash if they're eating the flowers? Because there are male flowers and female flowers on the squash vine. How can you tell which are the female flowers? They have an ovary underneath them. And you can see that. So if we're talking about a pumpkin, there's a teeny little green baby pumpkin there. And the yellow flower. And then the male flower doesn't have that. Also, if you were to look inside the flower, the male flower has the male plants, which are sticking up, male parts, which are sticking up. All right? And the female flower has this beautiful kind of wet, glistening hand in there. So that's also pretty obvious. The whole female part of the plant is called the pistil. And that's a little hard for us because we're used to P words having to do with male sexual organs. So I think of her as a pistil packing mama. And the female parts, as always, are more complicated than the male parts. And the male parts are called the stamen. Right? And they consist merely of a filament and an anther, which produces the pollen. No heavy-duty plumbing problems to worry about. No enzymes, nothing important. There are four stamen in the mint flower. Two are long and two are short. How come? This is an insect-pollinated plant. This is how dorms are now, boys and girls together, even in the same room. Right, so here we have the boys and girls together in the same room of the flower. And so we have two long stamens, which the bees, when they come to the flower, will brush against the pollen and then take that pollen to another mint flower and so be able to carry the pollen away. Should the weather be such that bees are not flying after the two tall stamens die, the two short stamens start to produce pollen and they are capable of fertilizing the pistil. So the flower does not totally depend on bees to pollinate it. If there aren't bees available, then it simply does it itself. We are resourceful, aren't we? Now, that the ovary then matures into a seed capsule, which contains four seeds here named nutlets. All right, they're seeds, and it's very easy to see this on motherwort. Has anyone looked at the motherwort seeds? All right, first of all, the calyx dries in the motherwort, doesn't it? And it gets very stiff and hard. And if you casually go to pull the motherwort out of the garden, she fights back. And it doesn't stick in you, but it is hard and tough. We say the mama is protecting her babies. She's got her babies in there, and she's going to stick her claws out and protect those babies. And if you look in there, it's a medicine wheel. You see the cross and the four seeds there. Is most easy to see in the motherwort, but it's true throughout the family. There are actually two chambers to the ovary. Think about a pea pod, right? One chambered ovary, but many seeds. Think about an apple. Cut an apple this way. How many chambers in the apple? Five. Five chambers, each of which has one seed. So the ovary can have one chamber and one seed, one chamber and many seeds, or two, three, four, five, that chambers, each of which has one or more seeds. In the mint family, the ovary has two chambers, each of which has two seeds. This may not make much sense to you sitting right here, but if you go home and start looking at your mint plants, this will become really obvious to you. Now, if we read the words here, it starts out by saying, if you pick a plant with a squarish stem and simple opposite leaves that is almost certainly a member of the mint family, I don't agree. Do cows have eyes? Yes, cows have eyes. True, cows have eyes. Uh-huh. So does that make her a cow? Does it make any of us cows? We have eyes. No. Yes, mints have square stems, but that does not mean that something with a square stem is a mint any more than we are cows. In fact, one of the most poisonous plants on the planet has a square stem and simple opposite leaves. Right? Lantana. Right? Commonly grown. It's grown as a bedding plant. It's grown in public places. And it is deadly poisonous. But it has a square stem and simple opposite leaves. So this is not a good way to identify mints. Right? The flowers are how we identify plants, not the leaves, not the stalks. Guess what else has a square stalk and simple alternate leaves? Nettle. Not a mint. Now, I could name plant after plant that has a square stalk and simple opposite leaves that is not mint. Don't use this as a way to identify. And it is commonly taught, isn't it? So it has square stalk, it's mint. If it's a mint, it has a square stalk. I remember walking into my very first logic class at UCLA, and on the board was written, if A equals B, B does not equal A. And I went, huh? All right, but here we had seen that, right? if cows have eyes, everything with eyes is not a cow. So be careful about that square stem thing. All right, let's turn our page over. Once we are able to recognize mints, we have now learned 3,500 plants. Right home. How many plants did you learn about at Susan's class? 3,500 plants. As well as a little bit of botany. There is no poisonous member of the mint family. Every member of the mint family is safe to use. They have some general characteristics, of which being aromatic is not one. Again, we tend to think because it's named the mint family that these plants must always have aromas, and yet we've already discussed one that doesn't, which is motherwort, right? Does not have an aroma. Skullcap does not have much of an aroma either, does it? Right? Nor does ajuga, bugleweed, dead nettle. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of the plants in the mint family have no smell at all. There's a plant in my area that the field guide identifies as wild basil, which has less smell than any plant I have ever smelled in my life. Who decided to name it wild basil? I don't know, and on what basis. Even the wild oregano is just barely scented. It has such little scent that we're able to put it in salads as a mainstay salad green. So we must depend on the identification through the flowers. Mint family plants in general tend to be very good at accumulating minerals from the soils. And mint family plants can grow in conditions from in water to very dry and arid places. Student came to one of the classes that I give twice a year in Woodstock, too far for some people to come 4 miles out to my farm. I can give classes in Woodstock as well. And she said, you know, it's spring and I'm going to go out and I'm going to plant an herb garden. Last year I had an herb garden and I grew thyme and rosemary and lavender, and I watered them every week, and I gave them fertilizer every other week, and I didn't get a very good crop. So this year I'm going to water them twice a week and give them fertilizer every week, and what did we say? No! Withhold that water. Let them get a little before you water them. And don't give them any fertilizer at all. You got a little stale infusion. You can pour that on them now and then. But really, they like poor soils, hot, dry conditions. Right? Whereas over in my wet meadow, where there's a little kind of rivulet, doesn't run very well. It just kind of seeps along. And there's a big patch of beautiful wild mint right in that water, right? So those extremes of conditions for the mint family plants, and yet wherever they are growing, they are looking for minerals. Mint family plants are especially good at finding calcium and bringing that calcium into their tissues. And how wonderful for us, because vinegar is the solvent for minerals. If we want minerals and antioxidants from a plant, then vinegar is a really great menstruum, which means your liquid, to use. And this is the time of the year to make your mint family vinegars, because you know there is going to be frost. And many of those mints, when the frost comes, are going to go, "Ah, I die." So get out there now and make your sage vinegar and your rosemary vinegar and your thyme vinegar. Basil vinegar doesn't do much of anything. Tulsi vinegar, very good. Opal basil, we dry the leaves and we make vinegar from the stalks. Any of these mint family plants, that you might be growing for culinary use, or of course you don't want the stalk, right? So you might dry your thyme, or you might dry your rosemary, or you might dry your lavender. And then if you strip that off the stalk, take those dried stalks and make a vinegar from them, and you will be surprised at how tasty it is. And of course, anything that comes to the leaf has had to come through the stalk to get there. And usually the stalk contains about 10 times more of what we're looking for than the leaf itself. Right? This is a little confusing sometimes to people because herbalists use a lot of words that sound like they just should mean what they say, but it's really kind of an herbal code. Right? Like if an herbalist says bark, do we mean bark? No, we mean inner bark, right? Right, in the same way, if an herbalist says nettle leaf, we don't mean leaf, we mean the stalk and the leaf. I have, tragically, seen people go out, harvest their own nettle, dry it beautifully, bring it in, strip the leaves off of it, and throw the stalks away. And they just threw away, all right, 10/11 of what they got. So we want the stalks, too. Very important to have those stalks. One of the reasons we think not about using the stalks, well, actually there's two. One is that most herb is sold cut and sifted, which means the stalk has been cut up, and then it's sifted so the pieces are the same size, and you don't quite grok that the stalk is in there. You don't see it. But think about the cost of nettle. How much you'd have to pay if it was only the leaves? There'd be no way that any of us could afford it, right? And also, we so frequently use the aromatic mints in cooking. And, of course, you do not want to have the stalks in your soup or your stew. Right? Textural problem. Right? So this leads us to the belief that we shouldn't use the stalks. We want the stalks. And when I make a vinegar from a dried stalk or from a fresh plant, I fill the jar to fairy mattress pack. So we want the jar full. And you want to press down a little bit with your thumb or a finger. And if you can actually press down into that, you don't have enough plant material in there. But if you can't press at all, then the fairy is going to get bruised. So there's got to be a little spring to it. You want a fairy mattress there. You want it well packed. It's just a little bit of give so that fairy can roll over and feel comfortable. And then right to the top of the vinegar. Now, I love to make vinegars. They're such a wonderful and easy way to get the nutrients, especially the antioxidants and minerals from the herbs into our diets. And vinegars, of course, can be put on our salads. They can be added to soups as we eat them. They can be put on greens. They're a tremendous addition to any cooked green, because again, they magnify the mineral uptake from that green as well. And I make a lot of vinegars. The apprentices make a lot of vinegars. As a matter of fact, I have 3 shelves in my dining room, fairly deep, filled front to back with herbal vinegars. And nowadays, apprentice groups are told you can only make a vinegar if you use one. There's no more room on the shelf. And what I have found is that if I use raw vinegar, I have made a science fair project, not an herbal medicine. So please never use raw vinegar in your herbal preparations. As a matter of fact, the vinegar that you buy at the supermarket, and I use only apple cider vinegar, the apple cider vinegar you buy at the supermarket is raw vinegar. It has not been pasteurized. And if you don't believe me, pour some over some plants, and wait 3 months, and you will see a vinegar mother growing in there, along with a lot of other weird, strange things. And at the very best, it will smell bad. And at the very worst, it will smell like a diaper pail that hasn't been touched for a year. And that smell gets into the glass, too. You might as well just tighten up the lid and throw the whole thing away. So pasteurize your vinegar, please. I go to the supermarket. In my supermarket, a gallon of vinegar is $2.79. How much is a pint of Bragg's? $5 or $6. And there's how many pints in a gallon? 8. So you can pay $50 for a gallon of vinegar, or you can pay less than $3 for the same vinegar. The same vinegar. And you need to take it home, pour it into a non-metal pot. Right. That would be like a pot that's lined with something. But if you put it in like a stainless steel pot or an aluminum pot, what does vinegar do? Oh, it absorbs minerals. We don't exactly want to be absorbing aluminum or the minerals in stainless steel. So it has to be an inert pot, something that is not going to interact. Bring it up to a rolling boil. Turn the fire off. Let it cool back down to room temperature. Put it back in your jug. And we take a marker and we put a big X on the front and the top of every jug that we have pasteurized. Once you make a vinegar with pasteurized vinegar, it will remain useful, viable, and potent for about 25 years. So it is definitely worth the small amount of time. I do it when I'm in the kitchen doing something else. I just pour it in a pot and I'm doing something else. Oh, it's boiling. Turn it off. And then I come back later that night and pour it back in the jug. There's no particular reason to use raw vinegar, especially if you are seeing to it that you are getting a variety of fermented foods, as we're eating here, right? Sauerkraut and relishes and things like that. So did you have a question or comment about vinegar? I'm sorry, I did not, in this class, mention that I do not like to be what about it. I don't find what about to be a question. What about your sweater? You see, it's not a question, is it? And I'm happy to answer you, but you have to at least put out the effort to ask me a question, please. Any vinegar would work. Are there books written about the healing values of red wine vinegar? Are there books written about the healing value of apple cider vinegar? Yes. Seems to me a pretty obvious choice. You have to pasteurize any vinegar that you use, yes. You could use rice wine vinegar. You could use, many, many, many people use water with acetic acid in it, which is called white vinegar. It's not really vinegar at all. It doesn't come from any plant. It's just acetic acid and water. And that works too, doesn't it? But I'm more interested in doubling up on my healing value, right? So I would never make a tincture in grain alcohol, because grain alcohol is lethal. Whereas vodka is actually healthy for you. My students called up and she said, "Can you help me? My mother's an alcoholic." I said, "How old's your mother?" 86. "Your 86-year-old mother is an alcoholic. Would she just start drinking a couple of years ago?" I said, "No, like most alcoholics, she's been getting drunk on a daily basis since she was 14. I said, "Excuse me. You're telling me that your mother has been getting drunk on a daily basis for 70 years? How's her liver?" "Her liver is great." I'm like, "Huh?" She said, "Yeah, well, the doctor says it's because she only drinks vodka. Vodka means water. I'm not suggesting it as a lifestyle, but your ordinary Russian drinks a liter of vodka a day. Your alcoholic Russian drinks 2 or 3 liters of vodka a day. Right? Drinking a liter of vodka a day is like drinking a liter of water a day. Right? Because it is to them water." Ooh, that makes me thirsty. I have some red clover infusion. There was a Siberian shaman who came to our community and gave a presentation. And she did not have a little jar of red clover infusion. She had a liter of vodka and a little glass. And she kept that glass full and she'd just walk over and she'd... And when the liter was empty, somebody replaced it with another one. In her two-hour talk, she got into that second bottle and she looked just fine the whole time. I kept, expecting her to fall down. But if I drank that much vodka, I would be a mess. All right? But it's her water. In every state in the United States and all through Canada, you can buy vodka. You can buy 100-proof vodka. You may have to ask. They may have to special order it, but you can get 100-proof vodka. However, there are many states, including the state I live in, where you cannot buy grain alcohol. Now, it's somewhat of a misnomer. This is another one of those kind of confusing things. Vodka can be made from grain, too. We're not talking about an alcohol that's made from grain. We're talking about a high-proof alcohol, which is called Everclear or grain alcohol. And if you were to drink a liter of grain alcohol daily for 5 days, you would die. How can I possibly justify making a medicine from something that can kill? I would never and have rarely used grain alcohol. Of course, when I was starting, I read the same books that you read, which said that you have to use grain alcohol or it won't work, right? And this always bothered me, because when I used grain alcohol and then I decanted it, the plants looked fried in there. You notice that? Right? The plants have been changed in a way that looks unhealthy. And I thought, wow, if it's doing that to the plants, what is it doing to my liver? You know, and I saw my liver kind of crisping up like a slice of bacon that's been left in the pan too long. All right. 80-proof vodka is not going to work. Right? Too much water in it. But your 100-proof vodka works perfectly, and it is the only thing that I have used to make tinctures for more than 25 years. And I have had my tinctures tested nose to nose with tinctures made from grain alcohol, and the vodka tinctures are stronger and more effective. They are just as long-lived, and I don't worry about the proportion. I don't worry about it. It doesn't matter if it's 1-to-1 or 1-to-2 or 1.5-to-1. It doesn't really matter. Unless you're going to manufacture herbal tinctures. And I'm going to guess that most of us aren't manufacturers. Is that right? Right? We don't want to make 1,000 bottles of motherwort and sell it. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. I'm very glad there are people, yay Red Moon, who are doing that. Huh? But we want to make tinctures for ourselves because we want to reestablish herbal medicine as people's medicine. We want to make this easy. You have a bottle of grain alcohol in your house, and there's a young child. You're putting your child's life at risk. That child finds that grain alcohol and drinks it. They can die. Their liver can be permanently damaged. You have a bottle of vodka laying around, and your child finds it. You're going to have a drunk kid that's not going to kill them. Not only that, I use herbal tinctures as my primary medicine. I don't take any pill of any kind. And when I need medicine, I'm going to take a tincture. And therefore, I believe it behooves me to make my tinctures from something that is not going to harm me, no matter how much tincture I take. And there are many herbs that I take in tiny amounts, but there are equally many herbs that I take in very large and lavish amounts. We know that Hypericum perforatum, also known as St. John's wort, but I call it St. Joan's wort, you know. It's a good protector against burns, and I figure Joan knows a whole lot more about burning than John does. Hypericum, we know that Hypericum is a very powerful antiviral. As a matter of fact, in petri dish studies, it can kill HIV. And in animal studies, it can kill HIV. And in human studies, it can kill HIV. But of course, these studies are not being done with the Hypericum itself. They're being done with one of the active alkaloids in Hypericum. And this went all the way to human studies, and it did indeed kill HIV in humans. However, it made them so sun sensitive that they couldn't even be with this much light coming in from outside. So it totally failed. However, I have friends who were diagnosed positive more than 25 years ago who have been taking a dropper full of Hypericum tincture every hour that they're awake and have not progressed to AIDS. Right? I have never seen any sun sensitivity from taking the tincture even in very lavish amounts. If we're going to be taking that much tincture, we sure don't want it to be grain alcohol. Okay. So, I gave you a list of some of the genera in this family. Genus is singular. Genera is plural. That is Latin. Right. So in the naming of the names, we start with species, which is the specific name. And then we go to genus, which is a more general name. And you think about those Russian nesting dolls. So the littlest doll is the species. And then we open up the next doll. And actually, in botany, we don't want to just put one species in the genus doll. We want several species to be in that genus doll. We do occasionally get families where there's only one species for the genus, but we don't like it. Right? We prefer to have numerous species in our genus. When I was in New Zealand, I went to a botanical garden which grew only sage. And they had 400 species of salvia there. Right, just think in your own garden. You might have beer garden sage. You might have salvia officinalis. You might have sports or hybrids of the salvia officinalis with purple leaves or with yellow and green mottled leaves. You might have salvias that grow tall with beautiful red flowers on them. Just in your own garden. You probably have 4 or 5 different species of salvia. Salvia is the genus. And then the specific plants have species names. The genus name cannot be repeated. There's only one salvia genus. There's only one mentha genus. And that name refers only to that genus. The species names can be repeated. So we have Salvia officinalis, Rosmarinus officinalis, Taraxacum officinalis, all right? Same species name, officinalis, 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 which was a species name that Linnaeus used for any plant that was medicinal, right? And then if a plant was sent to him from Canada, the species name was Canadensis. You're going to find a lot of Canadensis. Or if it was sent to him from Virginia, the species name is Virginiana, and you're going to find a lot of that too. So species names repeat, just like I'm Susan, and there are many, many, many other Susans. As a matter of fact, on the block where I grew up, there were 6 girls named Susan. So that species name can repeat, but in a different genus, right? Has to be in a different genus. The genus doll then goes into the family doll. So the family doll is the next bigger one. And again, we do not like to have a family with only one genus. We like to have many genera in our family doll. That family doll then goes to the natural order doll, which is the next larger doll. And once again, we like to have many families to put in there. When Botany in the Day was first published, he only went up to the family level, which is really all you need to know as an herbalist. And then people started wailing on him to put the natural order in, which he did. And then they started jiggling his chain about putting in subfamilies, which he did. And now it's gotten too confusing for you. Because you don't really need to be a good herbalist. You don't need to get that confused by botany. You just need to say, species, genus, family. Okay. Right? Because there are going to be things that follow along in step with these. So there are 180 genera in the mint family. Now, I told you that Linnaeus called this family the Labiatae. And this is a double bad boy name here. First of all, it's definitely smacks of sexuality, doesn't it, to call a plant Labiatae. But more than that, he broke the rule. Bad boy, breaking rules. The rule is that the family name must be the same as the typical genus of that family with a specific suffix added to it. Let's see how this goes. The suffix is A, C-E-A-E. And the easy way to pronounce any of these somewhat complicated names is simply to say every single letter. So A-C-E-A-E is A-C-A-E-A-E, right? You just say it all. Now, say out loud for me the first letter of the alphabet and listen to yourself. What do you hear? A-E. It's called a diphthong. It makes English very difficult for non-native speakers. Most languages don't have diphthongs. They don't have vowels that have two vowel sounds in them. So you're going to hear a lot of people say the family names is A-C-A. That finally is there, but it's kind of subsumed up into the A. Don't let it bother you. So let's see. We have the Rosaceae. What would be the typical genus? Rosa. Very good. All right. And we have a typical genus, Polygona. What would the family be? Polygonaceae. Okay, do we see how this fits together? Is this too confusing here? Do we need more examples? I'm getting the sense of this. So the labiatae doesn't do what? Doesn't end in A-C-A-E. Right. Well, we could say labiataceae. It is not more difficult to say labiataceae than it is, for instance, to say scrofularaceae. Right. Why don't we? Because he did not make any genus labia. There is no genus labia, so we cannot. And about 15 years ago, the Board of Nomenclature, everyone must have a job. And someone's job is to be on the Board of Nomenclature. The Board of Nomenclature lowered the boom and said, botanists, get in line. Shape up. Get your family names on schedule. And stop with this bad boy stuff. Botanists have always been a little out there, haven't we? All right, so the typical family is Lamia. Lamia is Greek for a spirit or the energy of an ancestor. Very lovely term, Lamia. And so our new family name is Lamiaceae. Lamiaceae, we are the herbalists caught in the middle. You're going to have to know both names. I was so privileged to bring out Julietta Berkeley Levy's book from my favorite book of hers, Common Herbs for Natural Health. And we fought mindfully over the title, because she does not like the title at all, and I love the title. Common Herbs, oh yes, Natural Health, wonderful. She wanted it to be called the Herbal Handbook. I'm like, boring. All right, so we see on that one I won. There are places where she won as well. All right, so I was very, very happy to be able to get the rights to that book and to bring it back into print, one of my favorite of all of Juliet's books. And of course, all of Juliet's books are wonderful, and I publish as many of them as I can get the rights to. The only two of her books that I refused to publish were her book on why you should never spay or neuter an animal. I don't agree. Spay and neuter your cats and dogs, please! Okay. And also her novel, I don't know if you know, she wrote a novel called Look the Wild Swans. And that the central thesis for Look the Wild Swans is someone who's very sick, and the way to cure the sickness is for that person to fast. And that person does not want to fast, they want to eat. And their caretaker, who's enforcing the fast and has all the food locked up, so this person can't get the food, is called away. And so goes away with all the food and carrying all the food in the house, so that this patient, this reluctant, recalcitrant patient, can't get any food. And the patient gets up out of bed, gets a gun, goes out and shoots a swan and makes swan soup. And of course, since it's Juliet writing this, the person dies. Right? They die because they've eaten in the fast. They die because they've eaten meat in the fast. They die because they killed a wild swan. All right, we might contrast that to a book I just finished reading called The Fasting Girl. fascinating book, a little dense, but fascinating nonetheless, which is a true story about a young woman who claimed to have not eaten. She started claiming to have not eaten for 3 years, and as the years passed, eventually it got up to almost 15 years that she claimed to have not eaten. And this was in the 1870s and 80s in Brooklyn. And this was a very interesting time period in medicine where we really have kind of a major clash between religion and medicine. And up until this point, medicine has been kind of quasi-religious. And at this point, medicine is really solidly moving towards scientific tradition, although there's still a lot of right up into the time when my mom was born, which was the early 1900s, where a doctor walked out of an autopsy and came to examine my grandmother. And, of course, she was dead 3 days later of childbed fever. Right? Because even in the early part of the 20th century, doctors still did not believe that washing their hands was important. So all of the religious leaders supported this girl and said she certainly was, she was being sustained by the love of God, right? She didn't have, her corporal body was meaningless and it was only her spirit that was, you can still hear these ideas floating around, can't you? Right? That the physical form is basically just shit, right? And it's really the spiritual form that we're concerned about, and that has pure nourishment, and the body is gross, and the nourishment of the body is gross, and fasting is good for you. It's not. Fasting is probably, as a woman, one of the worst things you could do for yourself. I mean, if pushed, I could probably think of something maybe worse, right? But not much. Think about it. How long can the brain go without food? How long do you get for the brain to not eat before there's damage? Minutes. 3 minutes of no food for the brain and you are brain dead. You will never again think anything. You will never again feel anything. You will never again read. You will never again write. You will be merely a body laying in a bed with no brain. 3 minutes! 3 minutes, those who are midwives know this 3 minute rule, right? You have some problem with the oxygen getting to the baby, you better do something within 3 minutes or that baby is going to be brain damaged or brain dead. You do not have a lot of time. So what happens if you don't eat? The brain has to eat, doesn't it? Where does the brain get food if you aren't eating? It breaks down your body. And for reasons that I can't explain to you and we don't really understand, the brain first attacks the heart. So when you are not eating, what you are eating is your heart. Another way to describe fasting is eating your heart out. Certainly, we could never confuse this with health of any kind at all. Now, that said, men thrive when they are tortured. It is very good for men to be tortured. It is healthy for them. And I have never had any man counter me when I say this. As a matter of fact, many men will clap and shout and say, that's so true. Right? Set me to, you know, dig in a ditch for 8 hours. I'm going to be healthier than if I sit around looking at the football game and drinking beer. Right? We are just, women get natural tortures. We get to menstruate, we get to be pregnant, we get to give birth, we get to go through menopause. We don't need to look for tortures. They will come to you in your life in one form or another. Right? So we very much want to be aware that any kind of fast, whether it's a juice fast or a this fast or a that fast, is going to impair your health for the rest of your life. Remember, you are not a toilet to be flushed. You are not a rug to be beaten. And you are not filled with toxins. As a matter of fact, in my view, there are no toxins. There's only food. There's only food. There's always something else to eat that thing that we think might be a toxin. And, of course, we are supplied with the liver, And our liver, every cell in the liver is replaced every 30 days, and kidneys, every cell in your kidneys is replaced every 6 weeks. And these are the organs that remove metabolic byproducts and other things from our bodies. So long as we have nourished the liver and the kidneys, we need have no fear of any kind about toxins. And unfortunately, most things that claim to cleanse damage the liver and the kidneys. When we are fasting, the liver, which again is removing those so-called toxins from the body, the liver slows down because we're not getting enough food in to start to continue the process of replicating the liver. 24 hours into a fast, even a juice fast, because there's no nutrition of any kind in juice, liver put through is reduced by 10%. In other words, you are getting 10% more of these so-called toxins in your blood after a 24-hour fast than if you were eating. After 48 hours into the fast, the liver is reduced in its ability to clear things from the blood by one-third. 3 days into the fast, liver efficiency is down to one-half of normal. Right. So not only do you eat your heart out, but you bring down the functioning of the very organ that is supposed to be clearing these things from your blood and your body. So we don't want to do that. So let's look at some of these genera and see how many of them are medicinal. Now, of course, I have handpicked a mere 43 out of 180. And at the bottom of the list is an illustrated flora of the northern U.S. and Canada by Britton and Brown. You are below the line that Britton and Brown covers, but I strongly suspect that there is a similar handbook for your area. It will be complicated. You might find it through your cooperative extension. Every state and every county has a cooperative agricultural extension. And that is usually, the office is usually located in the town that is the seat of the county. And you can go there for all kinds of help on things, including books on botany for your area. They often come through the central university system, so the University of North Carolina or University of Florida, wherever you are. In my area, the University of New York, New York University, puts out a 10-volume set of the plants of the Catskills. Very limited area. There's only like 15 counties that they cover. And the volumes are a dollar or two each. So you get really good, specific botanical information. And each plant has a county map and shows you if it occurs in that county. But really specific, clear information. So look for that information. And then a manual of vascular plants of the Northeast U.S. and Canada by Gleason and Conquest, which is often used in botany classes, and I make the apprentices look in it so that they know why they never want to take a botany course. You look in Gleason and Conquest and you run screaming from the room. It is so incredibly complicated, arcane. There's like a 50-page glossary at the beginning of the book, and you need it four times in every sentence to figure out what they are talking about, right? And again, similarly, that is Northeast, and then for your area, you will find a similar kind of thing. Ajuga, which is also called bugleweed, and these are beautiful plants. And I recommend that if you're not growing any ajuga, do so just because it's pretty. Often the leaves are kind of maroony, purple color, and the flowers are almost indigo. It's a low-growing plant. It's easy to underplant. It comes out in the spring and kind of keeps the soil nice as the other bigger plants, the peonies and so on, are kind of finding their way up. And then it blooms late in the spring, early in the summer with these pretty big, for a plant that only grows a couple of inches high, you know, 2 or 3 inch tall, a spike of these really beautiful dark, dark blue flowers. Teucrium, Germander. How many people here use Germander? Not used in America. It's European herb. Europeans, you look in European herbals, they're talking about using Germander, but I don't know anybody in America who uses Germander, although it is a medicinal herb. Trichostemma, I included this because I have a very large patch of blue curls on my land, and it, again, is really, really pretty. It's, again, a scentless little low-growing mint, and the upper lip is like this big blue eyelash that curls up. You think, ooh, so nice. Right? Scutellaria, 300 different skull caps worldwide. Right? Scutellaria lateri flora, the mad dog skull cap, is the primary medicinal skull cap used in the United States, although there are many other Scutellarias in the United States. It's now in print. Stephen Booner's new book on antivirals. I just got my copy. But I got to read this book in manuscript form because they wanted me to write a nice comment for the back of the book. As a matter of fact, my name is on the back of far more books than it's on the front of at this point. So we have the Library of Susan on the back as well as the Library of Susan on the front. And in this book, Stephen talks about the skull cap that's used in China and Bacchanalis, Scutellaria Bacchanalis, and that in China they use the root of the skull cap as an antiviral. And they consider it the most powerful antiviral. I was stunned. Oh, which is why I love doing this. No matter how much you know, you're always going to be finding out something new. You'll never, ever, ever know it all. It takes 7 lifetimes to become an herbalist, so be easy with yourself. Don't push yourself on it. You've got lots of time, and there's going to be all kinds of new things coming up, and things are going to change, and don't let that throw you. And Stephen puts the challenge out right there. He says, okay, American herbalist, I researched this, and the constituents in Scutellaria bacchanalis are the same as the constituents in Scutellaria lateriflora. Get out there and use it as an antiviral. Oh, and P.S., you don't have to use the root. These constituents are in the flowering plant. Wow, I already have a quart of skullcap tincture harvested from the skullcap on my land. And now I'm going to take Stephen's challenge and I'm going to see if I can use that as an antiviral. And you might want to as well. Marubium. Marubium vulgari. Whorehound. How many people use whorehound? Ooh, lots of bitter lovers. All right. I don't. Yuck. Whew, that is nasty tasting plant, huh? Man, there are so many other better choices than whorehound. It's just... Now, why on earth would we use something that tastes so vile when we have salvia? Sage does everything whorehound does and does it better. Sideritis, iron warts, agastache, giant hyssops. Our favorite, right, is agastache, finiculum, which is anise hyssop. A beautiful plant, gets pretty big, huh? In our area, we can get anise hyssop up to shoulder high and, oh, at least 3 feet across. Big plants. Bees love it. Love it. One of my neighbors and friends that we walk every week has a gorgeous anise hyssop. And we just like to sit there, drink our infusion, and listen to the bees. And there's never a time that there are not bees on the flowers of that plant. Beautiful, beautiful bee plant. Nepeta. Nepeta cateria. A wild catnip. As well as lots of other nepetas. I had an apprentice who stayed with me for quite a long time. Years, in fact. And she had pretty bad menstrual cramps. And she decided she was going to kind of use her menstrual cramps to find out about herbs. And she worked with a lot of different herbs, all of which worked to relieve her menstrual cramps. You know, there are literally dozens of herbs that will relieve menstrual cramps. And one of the ones that she really liked was catnip, because it does have psychoactive effects. As we know, if you ever watch a cat with catnip, you can see the psychoactive effects of the catnip. And so she's like, ah, I have some cramps, so I think I'll go get some wink, wink catnip. And she'd go out and she'd pick some catnip, because it does grow wild in our area, and she'd throw it in a cup, put boiling water over it, stir a little honey in it, and drink it down. And she said her cramps would usually disappear in 2 or 3 minutes. And then we came to the August that she was going to go to the Michigan Women's Music Festival. And she thought, uh-oh, I'm going to be bleeding when I'm there, and there's probably not going to be any catnip. What am I going to do? And I said, well, take some motherwort tincture. Motherwort's a wonderful cramp reliever. She said, no, I want catnip. Catnip is my ally. I'm like, okay, well, then figure it out. So it took her a while, but she decided that maybe she could dry some catnip and smoke it. So she did. She took the catnip, she dried it, and she rolled it up into catnip joints. And she smoked it, and she said, psh, eliminated her cramps even faster. So she rolled up 100 catnip joints, took them with her to the Michigan Women's Music Festival, and volunteered for Shift in the Womb, which is the healing tent. And first 100 women who came in complaining of menstrual cramps, not an uncommon complaint, got catnip to smoke. And she said 99 of those said their cramps were gone within 60 seconds of smoking the catnip. It really smells like cheap marijuana. Don't burn it inside if you are paranoid. Glaucoma. Glaucoma heteraceae. Creeping Jenny Gill over the ground. Ground ivy. When I first read about ground ivy in Common Herbs for Natural Health, I almost... Is that 10 minutes? Okay. All right. Okay. When I first read in Common Herbs for Natural Health about ground ivy, I almost made a terrible mistake because I thought she meant ivy that had been ground up. Hedera helix, English ivy, is poisonous. Had I harvested Hedera helix and ground it up as ground ivy, I would have damaged or killed myself and or my animals. Right, so I saw that it was very important to look at the botanical name of the plant, because the common names can be quite confusing to us. Now, ground ivy also has a lot of kind of bad names, because gardeners do not like this plant. Anybody have this in your garden? Mm-hmm. Do you like it in your garden? Why not? It spreads, and it mats, and it covers the ground, and every leaf node roots. So when you try to pull it up, you only get a little of it. And it's almost impossible to get out of your garden. So gardeners have a lot of cuss words that they apply to this particular plant. I would like you to know that it makes a really kick-ass vinegar. So don't weed your garden, harvest. Go out and harvest that. And you know what I find? Is that when I'm weeding a plant out and I don't like it and I'm cussing it, it really digs in there. And when I say, hi, I would like to harvest you and make a remedy, it says, oh, yes, and it just lifts up. Right? It makes my heart so much happier in the garden, too. I don't like to do warfare gardening. Why should I make war in my garden? Well, I will harvest vigorously. And I harvest for the rabbits, too. Those things I can't use get harvested for the rabbits. But it's all in love. I am harvesting you in love. I am giving death to my animals in love. It's giving death, and it's all in love. Because it's life and death. That is our spiral moving through there. So, and Creeping Jenny tincture is used wherever it is common and where its use is known by midwives to help bring out the placenta. Wonderful. As a matter of fact, what you find is that whatever the local mint is, midwives in the know are going to be tincturing it and using it to bring down placenta. The Mints, the whole family, is antispasmodic, right? How does catnip relieve menstrual cramps? It's antispasmodic. How does mint relieve gas pains? It's antispasmodic. How does motherwort work to relieve menstrual cramps? It's antispasmodic. So the whole family, in general, is antispasmodic. Right. Stopping spasms, stopping cramps, stopping pain from spasms and cramps, especially in the uterus and in the gut, especially in soft tissue, not so much in muscle tissue. But skullcap, antispasmodic for the blood vessels that feed the brain, which is why it's called skullcap, because the primary use in the United States now is as a headache reliever. Right? That's why it's called skull cap, I'm told. All right. Moldavica dragon heads. Prunella. Prunella vulgaris. I always think she must have been Cinderella's stepsister. Prunella, Prunella, come down here right now and try on this glass slipper. Prunella vulgaris. Are you the princess? Yes, I am. I am the princess. James Duke says that Prunella vulgaris has the highest levels of antioxidants of any plant tested. All right, you're spending good money for acai, you're loading up on blueberries, common weed right in your yard, Prunella vulgaris, or right in the vacant lot next to you, or even at the convenience store back by the dumpster, you're going to find Prunella vulgaris in all these spots. All right, she loves the city. She'll grow along the edges of the paths, out in the woods. She'll move wherever it is to offer her gifts of antioxidant power. And some herbalists now are finding out that it's also an antiviral. I think we're going to discover as we move into this and as viruses and using herbs to counter viruses becomes more important, I think we're going to find that this is probably a quality that, again, is a quality of this family with certain of the plants expressing that more strongly than others of it. All right. Dracocephalum. Whoa. The lion hearts. All right. And there are lion hearts that are considered psychoactive. Phlomus, Jerusalem sage, Galeopsis, hemp nettles, Lamium, the dead nettles, also known as henbit, scentless mints, not used much in the United States at all, but again, plants that are used quite a lot in Europe, especially the Lamium alba, the white Lamium, Leonurus, Leonurus cardiaca, and that is misspelled, and I apologize. There, it should be an A after the C. It should be cardiaca, little typo in our list. And that's motherwort, one of my all-time favorite plants. I call it one of the great remedies. Having motherwort around will help every passage in your life, puberty, menopause, menstruation. Keeps your heart strong and healthy. If you ask the people in Japan, why do you live a long time, they are not going to say tofu. Or miso, or seaweed, or raw fish. They are going to say motherwort. And they brew a wine out of motherwort. And they call it the elixir of long life. Right? Motherwort is especially important as a tonic for women's hearts. Women do not have the same heart disease that men have, and we don't have the same symptoms of heart attack that men do. Men tend to block up the major arteries coming from the lungs to the heart. Women don't. But in either case, man or woman, what motherwort does is causes a very intense replication of the capillary bed serving the heart so that any blockages in any of the vessels coming to the heart are literally bypassed by the capillary bed. My sweetheart, who had a triple bypass, and three of his major coronary blood vessels were 80% blocked. The surgeon came to his bedside afterwards and said, I have done this operation daily for more than 10 years. I've done it 4,000 times, and I have never in my life seen a heart with this much blockage. It is so healthy. We expected 25 to 30% of your heart muscle to be dead because it's not getting oxygen. In fact, there's not a single dead cell anywhere in your heart. And that's mother heart. So even if you don't have menstrual cramps anymore, you might want to consider some mother heart. We are getting very close to the end of the time. Five? Was that the five? Yeah? Balota, stinking whore hands. Stitches, clown's heel. Don't you love that? I want to find out about clown's heel, right? Betonica wood betony, right? A plant that has contaminated skullcap sometimes. Salvia, 500 different species of sage, including Salvia officinalis, our garden sage, and a wonderful one, clary sage, Salvia sclera. Monarda, another one of my favorites, especially the Monarda didyma, which is Oswego tea. I live in the area of the Oswego peoples. It's also called scarlet bee balm. Just a beautiful, beautiful plant. Wonderful for tea. I put a single stalk of Monarda in flower, dried in with my comfrey infusion when I make it. Hedioma, the pennyroyals. Hedioma pelugiodes. And this is a plant that you usually find because you're standing on it. It's very small, and you usually say, what's that smell? And you look down, and you're standing right on the pennyroyal. It is a plant that has gotten a lot of bad press because Jean Parvati, a dear friend, and we're so sad without her, wrote a wonderful book called Hygieia, which is just a fabulous book, and I highly recommend it. However, it is the world's worst herbal. And I, you know, Jeannie and I were very good friends, and I said to her face, it's the world's worst herbal, and she said, you're so right. She said, you know, it was one of those things that I did, and I really regret that I did it. Because if you look up, like, for instance, herbs that bring on the menses, you're going to find pennyroyal there. But in order to do herbal medicine, we need to know four things. We need to know what part of the plant. We need to know when it's harvested. We need to know how it's prepared. And we need to know what the dose is. And so when we're just said, pennyroyal will bring on the period, women go to the store. They ask for pennyroyal. They're asked, what form do you want? They say the strongest. They're sold pennyroyal essential oil. They go home. They drink the bottle of pennyroyal essential oil. And they die. And they die. And there's at least only half a dozen deaths directly attributed to women reading in some book somewhere that pennyroyal will bring on their period, but without adequate information about how to use it. And in fact, it does not work very well at all for that. I'm going to suspect that our time is over. I hope that it has opened you up to botany and to the mints and to how many there are. Go forth, explore, tincture, make vinegars, teas. Spirit of the plants has come to me in the form of a beautiful dancing green woman. The spirit of the plants has come to me in the form of a beautiful dancing green woman. Her eyes fill me with peace. Her dance fills me with peace. Her eyes fill me with peace. Her dance fills me with peace. Did we have enough of these?